Imagine you're locked in this really high stakes game of chess
Okay.
and you're completely focused, right? You're sweating over every single move and you're totally convinced that if you just analyze the board carefully enough, you can outsmart your opponent and win.
Makes sense.
But then you look down at your own hands and you realize you aren't the player, you're actually a pawn.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, and it gets worse. The entity sitting across the board has been playing this exact same game against you for eternity. And they already know literally every single move you're programmed to make.
I mean, that realization that you're operating inside a closed system with rules you didn't write, fighting an enemy who fundamentally controls the board itself, that's easily one of the most terrifying concepts in speculative fiction.
Exactly.
Because you're no longer just fighting an opponent, you know, you are fighting the actual parameters of your own existence.
Right. And that is the exact nightmare we are stepping into today. Welcome to a brand new deep dive.
Glad to be here.
Today, we are diving into this genuinely fascinating stack of source material. It's a massive collaborative fantasy roleplay and story log set in the realm of Mirari.
Which is such a rich world.
It really is. We're pulling from hundreds of pages of interconnected roleplay where the writers themselves are actually uncovering the mysteries of this world in real time, right alongside their characters.
And right now, things are not going well for them.
No, not at all. Currently, the realm of Mirari is just suffocating under this magical phenomenon called the Endless Winter. So our mission today is to decode the survival strategies of characters trapped in this incredibly complex web of political intrigue, hidden identities, and a literal metaphysical battle for reality.
And we really have to talk about the architect of this endless winter. It's this dark force known as Jack, or the Lord of Year's End.
The Lord of Year's End, such a great
It
title.
is. But the thing about Jack is, he isn't a traditional conqueror. He's not looking to, like, claim a throne or hoard gold or whatever.
Right.
His whole objective is the enforcement of a repeating cycle of time. So the heroes we're following in these logs, they aren't just crossing swords with monsters. They're basically attempting to fight the narrative loop itself.
Which is wild.
Yeah, they're trying to figure out how to break the rules of a rigged game from the inside. And that requires an entirely different kind of warfare.
It really does. And to understand how you even begin to mount a resistance against an enemy who literally controls the timeline, we have to start our analysis in the autumn suite of House October.
Let's set the scene there.
Yeah, so picture this warm, cozy room with blazing hearths. The sources paint this as a deliberate, stark contrast to the lethal, magical winter raging outside. And we're introduced to two characters in this room, a woman named Agatha and a young girl named Alice.
But Alice isn't just Alice, is she?
No, not at all. Politically speaking, Alice is a ghost. She is secretly Princess Angel, the presumed dead heir to the throne, and she's just hiding out in plain sight.
And her survival is, I mean, arguably the kingdom's most dangerous secret. But before the text plunges us into the gravity of all that, her companion in this scene provides this much-needed, almost surreal moment of levity.
Oh, I love this part.
Right. There's a greyhound in the room with them, named Kuon. And Kuon is furiously trying to scratch this decorative ribbon, which is tied in a bow around his neck. He's trying to scratch it off with his hind leg.
Which is just a funny visual. But then, with this quiet rush of air, the greyhound suddenly transforms into a man.
Just completely shifts shape.
Yeah. A small, perspicacious man, graying at the temples, dressed in green woodsman's clothes. He is the king's chief huntsman. He's basically been hiding in dog form just to ensure absolutely no one was eavesdropping on their secret meeting.
Which is incredibly smart.
It is. But Agatha's immediate reaction isn't to thank him for his vigilance. She scolds him for the ribbon.
She does.
She tells him, bows are for cats and kerchiefs are for dogs.
And Kuon, who is ever the polite huntsman, he just calmly corrects her. He notes that collars are for dogs.
Right.
It's this deeply human etiquette lesson right in the middle of this massive high-stakes conspiracy. But that brief moment of humor just entirely evaporates the second they get down to the business of the Lord of Year's End.
Yeah, things get serious fast.
The logs outline three rumored origin stories for Jack. First, that he was always dormant in Mirari and simply woke up when humanity arrived.
Okay.
Second, that he chased the original inhabitants there from some dark land beyond. Or third, and this is a pretty radical new theory that Kuon introduces, that Jack was manifested by the world itself the exact moment King Riordan was crowned.
So under that third theory, Jack acts as a sort of cosmic immune response to great change. Like if the world shifts too drastically, he just appears to reset the board.
Exactly.
But regardless of his metaphysical origin, his physical threat is immediate. The sources state he's been building an army of trolls and dark knights for 14 years. And I should point out, the text spells years with a capital Y.
That's a crucial detail.
Right, because we should clarify for the listener, when the sources use a capital Y, they are not talking about 365 days.
Not at all. In the lore of Merari, a year with a capital Y denotes an entire cyclical age. It's an epoch of time, you know, an era that eventually resets.
Wow.
So when Kua notes that Jack has been preparing for 14 years, we are talking about a scale of time and repetition that is almost incomprehensible to a mortal mind.
You.
He has spent 14 entire cycles perfecting his army and his strategy.
Which makes Agatha and Kuon's next move incredibly critical. They need to warn the queen about this army, but they face a massive political bottleneck here.
Right, because they can't exactly walk through the front door.
No, they cannot simply march the presumed dead Princess Angel into the throne room and announce she's alive. If the power-hungry nobles, specifically those from House April or House October, discover her identity, it would trigger an immediate civil war.
Because an endless winter creates famine, it creates desperation and economic collapse. And in that kind of environment, nobles become utterly ruthless.
Oh, absolutely.
If Lord April or Lord October saw the young princess, they wouldn't see a rescued child, right? They would see ultimate leverage.
Right.
They would use her as a political pawn, they'd claim a regency to rule in her stead, and the ensuing power struggle would completely distract the kingdom from the actual apocalyptic threat of Jack's army.
So their strategy naturally relies entirely on misdirection. Kuan decides to smuggle the princess into the palace disguised as a lowly cleaning servant.
It's a bold move.
It really is. He even checks her hands, noting she has no calluses, and warns her she has to be incredibly careful not to let her royal upbringing slip through her posture or her vocabulary.
Which is hard for a kid to remember.
Yeah, it actually makes me think of steganography, you know, like hiding a highly classified microchip inside a counterfeit penny.
Oh, that's a great analogy.
Right. You don't protect the most valuable thing in the world by putting it in a fortified vault where everyone knows to look. You protect it by making it look so profoundly insignificant that the enemy's gaze just slides right off it.
And that is the absolute essence of their survival tactic here. Agatha and Kuon acknowledge they lack the brute force to win a direct confrontation, so they deploy absolute stealth. They are moving their most important piece across the board by pretending it isn't a piece at all.
But Agatha's stealth strategy only works if the enemy's actually looking the other way. And the only reason Jack's forces are distracted is because across a realm in a region called Hawksmoor, someone else is making a very loud, very dangerous amount of noise.
Yeah, we move away from the warmth of House October to House November, into this dusty sitting room that clearly sees very little use, mostly because the local warriors just prefer the tavern.
Makes sense.
And here, the Lord Explorer Thomas has just returned Lord November's missing daughter, Hannah.
Okay, I have to interrupt really quick. I refuse to gloss over the fact that there is a literal tree man in this room named Abercrombie.
Oh, Abercrombie's amazing.
Right. The logs describe him having these planes of bark on his face and twiggy fingers. It's just such a vivid detail that reminds you of the deep ancient magic running through Merari, even in some neglected, dusty sitting room.
Yeah, and Abercrombie basically serves as Lord November's loyal servant. And he's quietly observing this deeply tense exchange because Thomas has just returned from a brutal campaign where he defeated a dark witch named Alyssa.
Okay.
But in achieving that victory, he actually confirmed the kingdom's absolute worst fear. Jack, the master of the Dark Witch, has officially returned to the board.
And Lord November is so overwhelmed with gratitude for his daughter's safe return that he offers Thomas immense riches from his vaults. He heavily implies he'd be thrilled if Thomas married Hannah.
Which Thomas completely rejects.
Flat out rejects all of it.
So.
He tells the Lord, in no uncertain terms, that his life is far too unpredictable and dangerous. He basically refuses to condemn anyone to the burden of mourning him.
Thomas is just this fascinating study in self-imposed isolation. He carries the psychological weight of this endless war entirely on his own shoulders.
Oh.
He views any personal attachment, wealth, marriage, domestic comfort as a fatal liability. He will not allow himself to have an identity outside of being the weapon that fights Jack.
So instead of a marriage arrangement, he invites Hannah to join his military faction, the Golden Hawks. and Hannah eagerly accepts, despite her father's obvious terror at the idea.
She wants agency in a world falling apart.
Exactly. But the part of this scene that really demands scrutiny is Thomas's broader military strategy. He tells Lord November he wants all the fractured houses of Merari to stop their petty infighting and pool their intelligence.
Which is standard alliance building.
Right, totally normal. But then he reveals his actual tactical maneuver. He actively wants Jack to know he's returned. He instructs Lord November to ensure the rumors spread far and wide.
His stated goal is to provoke Jack. He's hoping that by loudly announcing his return to the board, he can force the Lord of Year's End to panic and enact his master plans prematurely before his troll armies are fully mobilized.
Okay, but I have to push back on this. How does a mortal warrior justify waving a massive red flag at an immortal, nearly omniscient enemy who controls the weather itself?
It sounds crazy, I know.
It sounds like pure hubris. Thomas is painting a giant target on his own back. I mean, if Jack has been planning this for 14 cyclical epochs, why would one guy yelling, "I'm back," cause him to panic?
Your skepticism is totally valid, and it highlights the desperate nature of his plan. If we analyze Thomas's mindset here, he is engaging in high-stakes psychological warfare because he basically has no other options.
Mm-hmm.
He's attempting to dictate the tempo of a conflict where he is vastly outnumbered and outgunned.
Yeah.
If you wait for an immortal enemy to finish their preparations, you lose by default.
That's true.
So his only hope is to force a miscalculation. He is betting his own life that he can outmaneuver the architect of the board by acting unpredictably.
But his obsession with forward momentum just completely blinds him. He's so focused on taking the fight to Jack that he retreats down into the dusty Hawksmoor archives to write a letter to his old ally, Agatha.
Yeah.
And in the very act of writing that letter, he exposes the fatal flaw in his entire grand strategy.
He really does.
Because to understand why his letter is practically a suicide note, we have to look at what Agatha is discovering at that exact moment.
Right. So Agatha has traveled to consult the Lady Sorceress Nimue. And just the journey alone illustrates the incredible scale of this world.
It's so cinematic.
It is. Agatha stands at the edge of a frozen lake, shouts the name of a leviathan, and then physically rides the creature's massive glowing horn as it acts like a submerged elevator, taking her deep underwater to Nimue's spire.
And this golden-lit underwater study provides this isolated sanctuary for them to discuss a terrifying metaphysical twist, because back at House October, Agatha and Alice experienced something seemingly impossible. Reality itself, just for a moment, froze and went flat, like a painting. Agatha describes it as the world rippling like a flag caught in the wind.
And this introduces the concept of Ainitin. Our sources reveal that Ainitin is essentially the other side of reality. It's the game side.
The game side.
Yeah, the citizens of Merari are seemingly tied to counterparts in this alternate dimension.
Uh-huh.
So when people in Ainitin play out mock quests, for instance, a character named Simon playing a tabletop game mm-hmm. to find the Holy Grail,
right.
It has massive, tangible consequences in the physical world of Merari.
Wow.
Actually, finding the Grail in the game is what redeemed the dark wish that Thomas was fighting.
Wait. How does that mechanism actually operate? If Simon kicks up a plastic cup in the game world of Ainitin, does the Dark Witch's physical brain chemistry instantaneously alter in Merari?
Basically, yeah.
Like, is it a quantum entanglement situation where the game acts as the source code and Merari is simply the monitor displaying the output?
That is exactly the most accurate way to visualize the horror of their situation. Merari is the output monitor.
That is terrifying.
It is. The characters in Merari believe they possess free will. They feel pain. They strategize, they mourn. But their massive historical shifts are actually being dictated by players moving pieces on a board in Ainitin. They're living inside the software, entirely subject to the whims of the hardware users on the outside.
And right as Agatha and Nimue are unpacking this existential nightmare, Hannah arrives at the frozen lake above. She literally just got home to her father, but she immediately rode out through the winter to deliver Thomas's sealed letter to Agatha.
She doesn't waste any time.
None at all. She arrives at the underwater spire, visibly shaken from her own ride on the Leviathan Bridge, and hands over the correspondence.
So Agatha and Nimue break the seal, and Thomas writes that he has gone west to the ice jaw pit with his companions Rachel and Simon to face Jack directly.
Right.
He writes, quite poetically, actually, it's interesting how time and events seem to repeat themselves. 14 years ago, I sat in the archives writing you a letter, and today, I sit doing the same thing once more.
He genuinely believes he is making this profound observation about destiny. He continues the letter by writing, "Let us finally find an end to the endless cycle in Mirari. We have the power to change the rules."
But he doesn't realize what he's actually saying.
Exactly. Nimue and Agatha realize the absolute horror hidden in his own words. Because events in Mirari repeat themselves across these massive epochs, Thomas isn't breaking the cycle at all.
Nimue states the reality of his situation with chilling clarity. By repeating his actions, by sitting in the exact same archives, writing the exact same letter, and marching off to face Jack head-on at the ice job pit, Thomas is walking blindly into the exact same trap that defeated him 14 years ago.
Oh, man.
Jack doesn't just anticipate Thomas's move. Jack's entire strategy relies on it.
It's like a lethal version of Groundhog Day. It's not just that time is repeating. It's like Thomas is a skipping needle on a vinyl record.
Yeah.
He thinks if he just pushes down harder and fights more aggressively, he'll magically hear a new song. But he's just digging the exact same scratch deeper into the vinyl. Jack is the one spinning the record. You cannot win a rigged game by aggressively following its rules. If the board is structurally designed for you to lose, you have to step entirely outside the pattern.
Which forces an immediate and dramatic pivot from Agatha and Hannah. Agatha realizes a simple warning message won't stop a man as fiercely stubborn as Thomas.
No, he's way too locked in.
Yeah, he's too locked into his role as the heroic martyr. So Agatha and Hannah, who, mind you, just finished a grueling, freezing journey, decide they must physically ride out and chase Thomas down to intercept him before he reaches the ice jaw pit.
They just have to go themselves.
Exactly. And simultaneously, Nimue desperately sends her remaining peregrine falcons into the sky, hoping they can drop a warning message to him from above before it's too late.
The visual of those falcons flying out over the endless winter is just incredible. It's this desperate race against time, not to fight a villain, but to stop a friend from making a predetermined mistake.
It really reframes the whole conflict.
It does. So what do we actually take away from all this deep lore and magic? I think the core theme vibrating through these sources is the struggle between blindly playing the roles assigned to us by history versus recognizing the cycle and having the courage to forge an entirely new path.
It really invites a profound reflection on human behavior.
Yeah.
I mean, if you've ever stayed in a toxic job because it's the devil you know, or you found yourself having the exact same argument with a partner for the 100th time, you understand exactly what Thomas is doing here.
Oh, for sure.
He is choosing the comfort of a familiar war over the terrifying unknown of a new strategy. Thomas's heroism has calcified into a habit, and that habit blinds him to the reality of his own subjugation.
And Agatha is the vital counterpoint to that. She is willing to fundamentally change her understanding of reality itself just to find a new solution.
She adapts.
Yeah, she adapts. And that actually brings us to one final lingering mystery from our source text that I want to leave you with. In Thomas's letter, he briefly mentions discovering the true origins of Mirari's history.
This part is so fascinating.
It blew my mind. He notes that the legendary King Riordan's rule ties back to a figure named Ryan Jordan in the other reality, in Ainaton.
Right. And that single phonetic similarity, Riordan and Ryan Jordan, it recontextualizes the entire foundation of the world. It strongly implies that the legendary King Riordan is just the Mirari fantasy translation of a normal modern person named Ryan Jordan.
So if the citizens, the kings, and the warriors of Mirari are just echoes or digital avatars of real-world counterparts from Ainaton, what happens to the entire physical world of Mirari and everyone living in it if the players on the other side simply decide to wake up, turn off the monitor, and stop playing the game?
Does their reality simply collapse into nothingness? It forces us to view the endless winter through a completely different lens?
It really does.
Perhaps Jack isn't just a tyrant. Perhaps he's the automated mechanism keeping the game running when the human players have walked away from the table.
That completely flips the board. So the next time you find yourself repeating the same mistakes, feeling stuck in an endless winter of your own making, ask yourself, are you the player moving the pieces, or are you just a pawn following rules you didn't write? It might be time to stop playing the game and start dismantling the board.